Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome a high-flying academic to the show, an academic who is also deeply immersed in the practice of Buddhism. John D. Dunn is the Distinguished Chair in Contemplative Humanities through the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I love that title. It's just awesome. He's a graduate of Amherst College and received his PhD in the study of religion from Harvard University. And his work focuses on Buddhist philosophy and contemplative practice, especially in the field of mindfulness in both theoretical and practical contexts. And he's the author of Foundations of Dharmakirti's Philosophy and many scholarly and other articles. So it's a pleasure to welcome Professor Dunn to today's show. Welcome.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
You know, in a recent Dharma talk that you gave at the Appiah Zen Center in Santa Fe, which I love. I love that place.
Me
talked,
too.
Yeah, it's got a beautiful consciousness there, doesn't it? It's very peaceful. You talked in the Zen Brain series about what arises beyond conditioned or conditional mind. It's a sort of reawakening to spaciousness and open-mindedness. And we talk a lot about that. This unity, the idea that, you know, beyond the constructs or the story of our lives and of what we latch on to, that there is an inherent spaciousness that and that is we would call the sort of divine order, the inherent goodness of being, if you like. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, one of the key aspects of Buddhist practice, which I think relates to a lot of traditions, actually, is really trying to understand what the nature of our own experience is.
Right.
And when you think about it, you could say that, in a sense, all that we really have is experience. That's what what really is presented to us as reality is just our own experience. When we read books or, you know, we think or we watch TV or whatever it might be, all of those things are in a certain way one step removed from the immediacy of experience itself. You know, when you're looking at a beautiful sky, that sky is directly present to you in a way that thoughts and language are not. They're sort of a step removed from experience. So that immediacy of experience, in a way, is really the thing that Buddhists try to understand, because the idea is, the reason we're confused, or rather the reason we're suffering, is that we're confused. And what we're confused about is the nature of reality. If reality really comes down to what's presented in our experience, then really we need to understand experience. So how does that all get back to this idea of spacious mind? Really, it's just asking the question, well, if we want to understand what the nature of experience is, That means understanding what experience is in all of its different manifestations. You know, if we say, what's the nature of water? If water's frozen, if it's dirty, if it's steam, we want to know what it is in all those different situations. What's the same about it? What is, in a sense, its essence? And one answer in the Buddhist world is to say that the essence of experience is a kind of spaciousness. It's a sort of, the metaphor that's used is luminosity, actually.
Yes.
An openness, it is the knowingness, so to speak, of our minds themselves. It's a mere capacity to know. Now, that's all pretty abstract, but in some ways, it's something that we're always in touch with.
Because it's the natural essence of who we are, right? That would be the one way of saying it, I guess.
Yeah, you could say that, or one way to put it is this. We know we're aware when we're conscious. I mean, actually, my friend Evan Thompson, the philosopher at University of British Columbia, has just recently written a piece for Trends in Cognitive Science, an academic journal, about the notion that consciousness persists even in deep sleep. But let's set aside sleep for a second and just talk about, you know, waking consciousness. When we're awake, we know we're conscious. It's sort of almost silly to say, if I ask you right now, are you conscious, Paul? You may be distracted, right? Or you may be thinking about something else, but
right,
you know you're conscious, right? And yet somehow that knowing, the fact that we know we're conscious is something we completely lose track of. We get so absorbed in our thoughts, our world, our needs, our expectations, that we lose track of this sort of basic fact of our own consciousness. And that's,
ahead. No, please, go ahead.
Well, that's that. It's tapping into that level of our understanding and that basic fact of our own consciousness that is the sort of starting point of seeing through a lot of the stories that we tell ourselves that make ourselves miserable, actually.
Right. I was going to say that sometimes we can even conceptualize the idea of being conscious, you know, so we commodify that as well. So instead of it being a natural, spontaneous thing, we get hold of it and try and make it something it's not. You know, we're forcing the issue, if you like. It's like planned fun. You're trying to squeeze fun out of something instead of just having fun. You know, you make it into something it's not. And then the mind seems to do that, doesn't it? It seems to always remove itself from direct experience. The moment the direct experience happens, you know, then we begin to conceptualize it in some way.
Yeah, we take it as an object. We step back from it and we look at it. But there's a way in which the immediacy of experience is actually not presented to us as an object. It's something that we somehow know without objectifying it. And that's why they also talk about this kind of awareness as being non-dual awareness.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say on Sunday, I picked a particular scripture to start Advent, and the particular scripture is very Buddhistic, actually, I think. It's from 2 Corinthians 3:18, and it says, with unveiled gaze, we reflect and we receive and reflect the brightness of God. And you know, it's exactly what we're talking about. You know, the brightness would be the luminosity, I think. Of course, there's no God in Buddhism as such, but that really doesn't matter, I don't think. It's we receive and reflect the luminosity of what is with unveiled gaze. You know, it's so often we conceptualize our gaze, right, instead of just seeing without judgment or whatever, you know. So I love that idea. With unveiled gaze, we receive and reflect the brightness of God.
Yeah, that's beautiful, and that that's really in the spirit of what I'm talking about. That
right.
You know, because part of what happens, and that's I think when you reflect and receive the brightness of God, or what would be called the luminosity of the nature of the mind itself.
Right.
Which is also, in a sense, the Buddha mind, you know. That's the mind of the Buddha, too. So maybe there's not such a big difference between that and God in this context. But anyway, when one is doing that, the sort of small individual self melts away, right?
Yes.
The sense
yes.
of, the sense of sort of me against the world, that I am here and the rest of you are out there, that all, I think, disappears in that moment of receiving and reflecting that luminosity.
And then suffering disappears because right. Suffering is based on this idea of, well, it's this sense of separation, right? That I'm different from others, that I'm threatened, I have to be defensive or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those movements are very powerful. They can also be disturbing sometimes, actually, to feel oneself dissolve in that fashion.
Absolutely. I think that's why most people shy away from this, you know, because it seems like a kind of annihilation. And of course, the Sufis talk about that, right? They talk about annihilation as a necessary step in finding the truth of one's being, you know. But it is frightening because it threatens the whole construct that we've created for ourselves, right?
Yes, you know, the sort of the story of I am this person walking through the world, getting what I want and avoiding what I don't want. That story, that sense of this I, it really is, sometimes we talk about it as the narrative self, the sense of this, my sense of myself as a kind of character in a tale that I'm telling, that all dissolves from that standpoint.
Right.
And I think,
you know, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think part of the reason it dissolves is that the only way we can tell that story in a sense is if we're not in it. We have to separate ourselves from it. We have mm-hmm. to sort of objectify ourselves. And the question is, well, what's the standpoint? Where am I seeing myself from when I do that? How do I see myself? How can I talk about myself? Because when I'm talking about myself, well, who's that then?
Is yeah,
that
also exactly.
me?
Yeah.
Right? I remember one of my earliest kind of spiritual experiences in my early 20s was when I was going through a hard time, kind of identity crisis, trying to figure out who I was. I'd left the United States Air Force Academy where I had been for a couple of years, and I finally couldn't take it anymore. And I wanted to be an astronaut, you know, which is a kind of, I suppose that's sort of a transcendental trip in a way.
Yes.
So someone had taught me some very basic meditation, and a lot of this style of meditation involved a kind of meta-awareness where one tries to sort of see oneself. And I saw myself on a stage in a way. It was the image that came to my mind. I felt like I was looking at myself on a stage. And then I suddenly asked, well, who's looking? Who's doing this looking?
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on another stage. So now the audience is the stage, and I'm looking at myself in the audience, looking at a stage with myself on it. And then I asked again, well, who's doing the looking? And then again, and again, and again, and again. And it just was, it was an infinite regress, and everything fell apart for a moment. But it wasn't frightening. It was actually, it made me laugh out loud.
Uh-huh. It's kind of a weight off almost, isn't it? It's like a relaxation into something. You know, I don't have to be all this anymore. It's
right.
You know, it's taking a big weight of responsibility away from yourself somehow.
Yes, and also recognizing that the story, you know, part of it, when I, especially for young people, sometimes there's this sense, I think especially maybe in our culture, that, you know, you've got to figure out who you are. What's your true story? What's your authentic story? Mm-hmm. And to recognize that all the stories are just stories, and to be able
yes.
to let go of that can be really, it can indeed be a weight off.
You know, when I was 5 years old, we moved from the country to the city, and my grandparents were stewards of a country club, a golf club in Wales, and I remember being very upset because it seemed to be all bricks and concrete, you know, there was no greenery, and I remember distinctly going away from my body at night, about a couple of hundred feet above the house. And looking down and saw that there was a greenery in the back garden, and I felt relaxed, and I came back down into my body. And I know for years I thought, well, that's just a dream. But then I thought, maybe not. You know, maybe I'd actually gone up there to check it out. And that was my first sense of, you know, this presence awareness that was, you know, watching and looking beyond myself. But I like to think that was, you know, the beginning of my spiritual quest in a way, you know, to separate myself from my body mind in some regard.
Yeah, and that's a that new standpoint is what's really intriguing about that new standpoint is whether, you know, some traditions say, well, that's a kind of capital S self. It's a new self.
Right.
But it's not really a self in the usual sense, is it?
I think that, you know, in Buddhism, and I know you're really into sort of the Occam's razor viewpoint on spirituality, right? If you don't have to add something, don't add it. Dharmakirti was like that too, wasn't he? This idea that he was interested in what's efficacious rather than creating, you know, over many subtle constructs around things. So, you know, if you don't need to name it, why bother, right?
Because
they're only provisional names anyway, aren't they? We can call it the Christ, Buddha nature, you know, Great Spirit, whatever, but that doesn't really get to what those things are, you know, what that essence is.
And yes, another way of saying it is a model. A map is only a map. A model is just a model. It's the
right.
map isn't the territory. So whatever version, you know, whatever kind of, however we try to name it, whatever language we're using, whatever system we're deploying in order to name it, those are always only going to be partial, and they're going to carry their assumptions, and they're also going to obscure it at the same time as they name it, right? Whatever
right.
it is. Even saying it is already saying too much.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, there's a wonderful man named Tony Parsons. He's a non-dual thinker and has written a number of books, but he had a breakthrough walking through a park in London back in the 50s, I think, where he just started realizing his mind was filled up with all the hassles of life, and then he began to notice his feet walking, and then he began to let everything slip away. There was only the feet walking, and then there was just noticing the park around him, and then there was nothing. It was just a sense of peace, a sense of that he wasn't walking, that he wasn't doing anything, that all these things filling his mind were inessential in a way, and he was flooded with this sense of love, that everything was in, you know, like we say, divine order, was just the way it is, as it is, as he put it, and it changed his life completely, you know, and it was 40 years before he wrote it down. He went back into his regular life, but with a new understanding, and I thought, yeah, that's it, isn't it? You know, it's beyond, he said, I couldn't really explain it, you know, it just was, what it was, it is what it is, and I didn't want to explain it. I think that's why it took 40 years before he wrote anything uh-huh. down about it.
Yes, well, that sounds actually very wise to me, to not want to explain. I mean, our need to explain, our need to come up with reasons for what's happening is actually can be very useful, obviously.
Right.
But also, because that need also is a kind of need to think that we've got it all figured out, right? That sort of reality is under our control, and that's the big part of the problem. His experience reminds me of this Tibetan quote, I just see if I can remember how it goes. By the famous, it's actually originally in another language, an Indian language, but it means it's by Saraha, the famous mystic from the 11th century. And it means this mind itself all tied up in knots. If one releases it, it will undoubtedly be free. And I think when that release happens, yeah, it's blissful.
Yes.
Just letting go.
Right.
Well, it's kind of letting go of the need to explain, of the need to be a person controlling the world.
Yes.
All of those, you know, that sense of the philosophical term is agency, and that's kind of that's sort of the main illusion in some ways, that there's an I here who is in control, like a little guy, you know, like there's a Woody Allen movie, I can't remember which one, but he sort of pictures himself inside of his head, you know, with a little crew around him, and he's running the show.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like a little, so maybe slightly desperate captain trying to make this ship go the right way. But there is a captain. There's somebody in charge. And that's kind of the main illusion in many ways. So just seeing your feet moving, yet you're not moving them. They're just moving.
Yeah.
That's the kind of experience in which that illusion of someone being in charge starts to fall away.
Just falls away. Yeah. Very good. Well, yeah, I think it's one of the Lojong teachings. It says self-liberate even the antidote is one of the,
yes,
the slogans. And that's exactly what we're talking about, you know, to self-liberate even that which appears to be the solution. The solution can get in the way if you make a god out of it or an entity out of it. So
exactly. Yeah.
Folks, I'm with John D. Dunn. We're talking about fascinating subjects here. And when we come back, we'll talk some more about mindfulness, what exactly that is. And it's, of course, it's a popular theme right now in many religions, this idea of mindfulness. Even the Christian teachings have taken it over. And we'll talk more about what it is. But listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be right back. See you in a couple of minutes.
If Unity Online Radio has helped you grow spiritually through programs like this one, please consider supporting this online radio programming. Visit www.unity.fm and click on Donate Now. Thank you for helping us continue to serve as the voice of an awakening world.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with John Dunn, and we're talking about aspects of awareness and healthy mindedness and mindfulness, which is a subject that's commonly taught in Unity churches now and throughout Christianity, as well as its traditional home in Buddhism. And I was reading an article that you'd written, John, and you talked about, you know, classical and then the non-dual mindfulness. And I guess being in Unity, I immediately jumped to non-dual because that's the thing that fascinates me the most. But there was one phrase you had in that article, let go, don't correct, be free of expectation. And it sort of piggybacks on some of the things we were just talking about earlier, that nothing's to be abandoned, nothing's to be adopted. You know, it's all in harmony. It's all well. All is well right now, and that we just need to learn how to unlearn, as the Sufis say. Right?
Yes, that would certainly be in the non-dual traditions. That is the central theme. That, in a sense, the problem is again trying to be that controller, the agent who's going to fix everything. That standpoint it would be great if it worked, but the problem is that it's an illusion, and therefore it could never work. So that there's a, and part of the way we can discover that is that we can discover that our awareness of our that sense of subjectivity actually has to come from a different place. And mindfulness is very closely connected to that.
You know, it seems sad to me that, you know, when I reflect on this and share with people who've been studying, you know, various paths for decades in some cases, you know, still locked into their conceptual minds. I remember chatting with a Zen Buddhist who'd been studying, you know, seriously for a number of years, and the poor man, and again, this is my judgment, so bad, but...
well, you know.
But, yeah, there we go. But you know, the guy was all wrapped up in knots about all the various nuances of everything, you know, and didn't seem to be free. Didn't seem to have the you know, the open-minded, joyfulness that one would hope from practice. And you know, I could say the same for myself, perhaps, you know, that how long is it going to take? I know there is no time, but... It seems like the mind resists just the natural. It always wants to create something more fancy.
It does, and I think part of that is really that the mind is trying to you know, figure reality out so that we can be that the ego, so to speak, is trying to figure reality out so that the ego can be eternally happy and never have to suffer again.
Right.
Right. So it's that standpoint of the striver. You know, and this is where the idea of striving and of being effortful becomes very important. When I'm trying to do something, that I am trying. I'm in the standpoint of the person, that sense of being an agent, of the one who is actually engaged in an activity, the doer. So that standpoint of the doer, immediately from that standpoint, there's a world out there, or even my own thoughts can become objects in this way to me too, or my emotions or my own body. There's something over there and I'm going to get that thing and fix it, or I'm going to eliminate it. If I'm driven by attachment, I'm going to go grab it. If I'm driven by aversion, I'm going to go destroy it, whatever it might be. It's that standpoint of I am going to do this. And the idea here is that entire standpoint is actually an illusion certainly from the non-dual Buddhist traditions, which doesn't mean we have to, you know, stop talking and stop using language, stop even making judgments, but rather that we get a different kind of relationship to our language, a different kind of relationship to our thoughts and our judgments. So go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the key here is to ask ourselves, well, how do we know that this is an illusion? Maybe there really is like a guy in here controlling things. You know, maybe there is the little captain in charge of this ship. And how do we? That's one of the real questions. That's really an experiential question, a question to explore. How do we discover that that's an illusion?
Right. Yeah. Well, again, it's very frightening. You know, the three marks of existence, you know, that the Buddha taught, again, sounds so life-denying and horrific if you're coming from, you know, a certain viewpoint. You know, the idea that everything's subject to, you know, is dissatisfactory, is subject to suffering, and is impermanent, and there's no self, right? That makes everybody feel better, right? If you're coming from an ego-based point of view, because it's like, my God, you know, that's no fun. But when you understand it from the spaciousness, I think it's wonderfully freeing, isn't it? That everything is subject to impermanence. That you know, as long as you try and hold on to happiness, you're going to find suffering. And as long as you think you are something discrete, you know, a soul or whatever, that's all kinds of trouble, really. Because, you know, what does that mean? So it's frightening, but it's also liberating at the same time. Those three aspects of existence.
Yes, and of course the key one is selflessness, and the way I've been talking about it is selflessness really means realizing that sense of being, of there being someone in control, is an illusion.
Right.
That's the key one. And yet there is a way in which that's obvious in every moment of experience, actually. I mean, one claim in the traditions that come out of what's called the Great Perfection, Dzogchen, and the great seal, Ma Mudra, practices of Indian and Tibetan Buddhism is that this is actually the nature of experience, the moment-by-moment nature of experience always is showing us the fact that this sense of being in control can't be true, actually. There can't be someone who is sort of behind the controls. Because this, our sense of being... So let me give you an example, actually. Let's say, are you sitting down right now, Paul?
Yes, I am.
I'm not going to tell you something that's going to shock you.
I think I am.
Well, now you think you are.
I'm sitting down. I'm not sure right now.
And now you think you are because... Exactly, because I asked you, right?
Yeah.
So a couple of moments before you were sitting down, did you know you were sitting down?
Yeah, well, I probably did somewhere in the back of my mind, but not really. You know, it wasn't important.
Well, that's well, right. So, but somehow you knew, you did know. It, I mean, there is a sense in which you, of course, know what your body position was.
Right.
It was encoded with your experience.
Right.
Or for another, here's another example. So you're listening to me now, right?
Yes.
So how do you know it's you listening to me?
Because I've become comfortable with you? Myself.
So it's like a ridiculous question in a right in a way.
Right. In a way, right. Yeah.
So it's just, well, obviously there's this sense of me. So where's that knowledge of that sense of me, the knowledge of what we call subjectivity, right? The sense
yes.
There is a listener. Who's knowing that? How do you know that? Here's another example. So let's say you and I go and we're on the plains of Tibet or something. That's a nice place to be. And we wake up in the early morning and we crawl out of our tent. You know, we're on some long, you know, mystical voyage, let's say.
And lovely.
We crawl out of our tent and there's a beautiful sunrise. And, you know, and then we sort of need to go back in the tents and get our cooking gear out or whatever. And I ask you, we go back in the tent and I ask you, well, how did you feel about that sunrise? It was so beautiful. Let's just suppose that it was incredibly beautiful and that you were completely absorbed in it. I could see that you were completely absorbed in it. You weren't thinking about yourself. And yet, do you think you could tell me how you were feeling?
I'd say don't spoil it.
Well,
because I'm coming from a Zen koan point of view right there.
But you could come up with a description, right?
It's not. I could. Yeah.
It's not like you were completely ignorant of what you were feeling.
No, of course not.
It was part of the experience, but you were totally absorbed in the object, so to speak, in the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of that aspects of your own experience were also being presented to you, right?
Right.
So that means that there is a way in which we are aware of all of that sort of what you can call the kind of the background in a sense. Our emotions, our body position, and most importantly, our own sense of being a subject, like the one who's looking out from behind the eyes or the one who is listening now here, that those are all being presented even while we're not paying attention to them.
Right.
So that means that consciousness is presenting not just objects, like we're not just knowing objects, we're also knowing sort of the subject. At the same time. So how do we know a subject? There's not a new subject. It's, remember the stage thing? It's not like I have to step back and say, well, for example, let's say, you know, you're in the tent after looking at the beautiful sunrise and you say, wait a second, I got to go back outside and look at the sunrise again. And I'll turn inward and sort of check to see what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You don't need to do that. We don't need to turn ourselves into objects in order to know our own subjectivity.
Nice.
We don't need to sort of introspect to know what our body position is. It's just presented as part of our experience. So that's the sort of non-dual aspect of experience, that we're knowing ourselves without making ourselves into objects.
There's a sort of allowing the flow here. You know, flow is a big part of this, I think. I like, it was Dogen, I think, that said, the great Zen master, he said, the green mountains are always flowing. And, you know, to me, that what he's talking about is not literally whatever the mountains are flowing, but the idea that there is a, an interrelated flow between subject and object, between awareness and my recollection of that awareness.
Yes, that's beautiful. Yeah, that I had forgotten about that phrase from Dogen, and that's a very beautiful example, because what's really key here is exactly the idea of effort. You know, when we are trying to do so, in a sense, if I try to see myself, I end up, you know, kind of chasing my own tail, or I end up sitting on a stage looking at myself in the audience, sitting on a stage looking at myself in the audience, sitting on that sort of infinite. If I try to do it, I can't do it.
Right.
Because by trying, I take up that standpoint of being a doer, of being the controller, right? The one who's in charge. But if I let go of that effort, what they say, it has to be anabhoga in Sanskrit. The effort has to be effortless.
Right.
If I let go of the need to be the doer, then suddenly it's all immediately manifest to me. Effortless.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the actionless activity kind of Wu Wei idea of,
right,
you know, of Taoism as well, that
yeah,
idea. Otherwise, you get into some kind of neurosis or schizoid disorder here, you know, because then we're trying to we can blow our minds, if you like, you know, if we try and have too much effort in doing this. I think
yes, we can definitely do that, but also I think another thing is we just exhaust ourselves.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, absolutely.
There are some practices in which you do that on purpose. You exhaust yourself either physically or mentally until finally you just can't do it anymore. And then suddenly you see something.
There's right? An opening. Yeah. Right,
yeah. And exactly. I think you can see some of the asceticism of the Desert Fathers actually as being, I think, in that mode as well. You know, they're in a certain way, there are kinds of practices that can be dangerous practices, but that are about kind of exhaustion. And then you reach.
Right.
You reach your limit and you just can't anymore. I can't figure it out. I can't do anything. And then that's when it becomes manifest, or when the breakthrough happens.
I think that's a great technique, actually. Somebody taught me that one time, you know, that if you've got a problem, just instead of trying to deny it, make it the biggest problem it's ever been. You know, I'll never overcome this. It's terrible. It's overwhelming me. And after a while, it becomes so, you know, ridiculous that, like you say, there's a breakthrough, you know, that you can't take it anymore. And in that opening, there's relief, you know, because I've blown it out of all proportion. So it's become so silly and so ridiculous it's non-existent anymore. It's like a balloon that you blow up. Eventually, it bursts.
It just pops. Know? Yeah, that's
yeah, it just pops. Yeah.
It's similar,
yeah.
Very similar. And these things, I think, you know, they really do connect in many ways to mindfulness too, especially more in a non-dual vein. Which you know, one of the ways of talking about what that is. I like this phrase from Tibetan, Maing Tsamgi Jampa, the mindfulness of mere non-distraction. And that has many layers of meaning, but one of the really interesting meanings of that is that basically we're always mindful. In every moment, actually, we are mindful. Maybe we'll put aside deep sleep and so on, but the fact that I'm conscious means I'm being mindful in a certain way.
Right.
Right. Which is, I sort of don't lose fact of my consciousness. That's something that even if I'm not paying attention to it, somehow I know it.
Yes.
Right. It's always there. So that kind of mindfulness is sort of, rather than mindfulness where I'm trying to focus on an object and keep it in my awareness, I'm making an effort to retain something. This is a different sense of mindfulness. That first kind where you're focusing on an object and so on can also be very useful. That's more the classical style. But in the non-dual style, it's really cultivating this kind of fundamental awareness that is not about effort.
It's like a meta awareness.
Yes, exactly. It is very much like a meta awareness, except the one problem with meta-awareness, and this is where you can make yourself a little crazy, is that meta-awareness as a term, you know, meta kind of means above or beyond. It's as if it seems like we take a standpoint where we take a step back and now we're looking.
Yeah.
The, The problem with that is that very often what that means for us, and maybe especially, Westerners, is that it means we're sort of looking inward, right? I'm going to see inside myself who I really am. And then there's this sense of kind of turning in to find something inside. But that just leads to a kind of, can lead really to even a frightening situation of where there's just me and myself.
Right.
And I lose connection with the rest of the world. I sort of become fascinated with my own self. And I'm still in a very, I'm in a totally dualistic mind state. I'm trying to see myself. And because that becomes impossible, of course, for the reasons we already know, right? The sitting on the stage looking, sitting on the stage looking. We're never going to be able to do that. That can really exhaust you, but it can also drive you a little nutty, I think.
Right.
So that kind of mindfulness of trying to – mindfulness is not about turning inward and trying to see yourself. It's about sort of letting go and noticing or allowing this capacity that is always presenting our own sense of being subject, that is always presenting our emotions, our body position and so on, how I'm feeling, am I hungry, have I eaten enough? All of those kinds of issues are being presented to us all the time. And it's because we're so busy trying to do stuff that we don't allow those signals, so to speak, to reach us, right?
Yes.
To reach
yes.
consciousness. So learning how to kind of not do something, but actually undo, to let go, and become aware in that fashion is this style of mindfulness, which is always available to us because it's actually a feature of consciousness itself. It's what it means to be conscious in a way.
You know, there's a tendency in contemplation to become quietistic, whatever. And it became a heresy in Christianity because it was just simply, like you say, going more and more into the interior awareness without the need to do anything. And it's not about that. As we said, it's actionless activity. You're still moving through this world. I got into trouble a couple of weeks ago because I was on a show with a person who's very much into A Course in Miracles, which is a sort of a channeled text. And much of the Course in Miracles makes sense to me. It's non-dualistic. It's about forgiveness. But I have a problem with the idea of, the fact that everything's an illusion, except the real, which is the spirit or God or whatever. And I think things do have an existence, even though they may not be real. You know, they exist. But this person didn't agree with that. But anyway, I said, well, wait a minute. I read in John Donne's book that, and this is where you come in, John, that I can't remember what part of the foundations of Dharmakirti's philosophy it was, but I read that, you know, the fact that things arise and disappear is evidence of their reality. If they were in a form of stasis, that would be unreality. And I kind of like that idea. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think then that can actually be really helpful for, you know, on a spiritual journey. There are times when, in a sense, we're not really sure what's real.
Uh-huh.
What's very helpful about, you know, that type of insight is, well, what's real is just what's happening. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that our explanation of what's happening is the case, or even that we can label accurately what's happening. But the fact of sort of, in a sense, the fact of experience is what we mean by reality in a very limited, minimal sense. That mm-hmm. is very grounding. So if I am hearing your voice when you speak, or I'm feeling the chair on my bottom, that's reality in a sense. Those minimal sensations, and the way
even if it's impermanent, right?
Even if it's in fact, it has to be impermanent in order
right.
for it to be reality. Because reality here really means kind of causal. That there is a causal process that is.
Right.
Where stuff is interacting with consciousness, and that stuff, we don't even have to say whether the stuff, I like the word stuff, it's a good descriptor, it's a good philosophical word, actually. It could be matter, it could be not matter, we don't even have to decide whether it's matter or not matter, but there appears to be interaction with our senses, such that various experiences occur. And
right.
all of that presents itself as causal. And from the standpoint of experience, that's all we need, right? there, we don't have to decide whether this is ultimately true or not ultimately true, or reality or not reality. At a very basic level, it's just this flow of sensation that is occurring, and that flow of sensation is occurring in a causal way, which means that whatever is real is just whatever can interact with our senses causally.
Right.
And since it's interacting, that means it has to be impermanent. There's a whole argument there, but a very simple one is just this. If it comes into contact with our senses so that it can causally create an impression, you know, a sound, I say, om, that sound, when I say that sound, it didn't exist before. And then it comes into being so that it interacts with the with our oral sense, with our ears, and right. And then we hear something. So it had to previously non-exist, then it exists, and now it ceases to exist. Otherwise, we'd either hear it all the time or we'd never hear it, right? So it has to be momentary. It has to be impermanent. The things that we are, our sensations are coming and going, they always have to be impermanent.
Now, and that's exactly what Tony Parsons felt when he was walking across that park, you know, that each footstep was unique. It was never to be repeated again. You know, it was valid when it was happening, but then it was, you know, gone forever, replaced with another one. And the same idea, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yes, it is exactly the same idea. Now, and the really intriguing thing is to say, well, is the awareness itself, not the subjectivity, not the sense of I, because that's actually also shifting all the time too, right? With each new object, in a sense, we have a kind of new I. Each new sensation,
yes,
there's a new I. There's a slightly different sense of subjectivity. You know, the Western phenomenologists notice it, that the sense of subject, the subjectivity that's beholding visual objects is different than the sense of subjectivity that's hearing sounds. You know, there's a slightly different subjectivities in each of these moments. So those are impermanent too. But is the sort of consciousness, the space of consciousness itself, is that changing or not? That's a really interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in one
Absolutely.
Way, changing its content is constantly changing. But as consciousness, is it changing or not? It's really, I don't know the answer to that one, but there are various ways of thinking about it. It's a good riddle to ponder, I think.
Well, and you know, when I think of, you know, it's even though the Course in Miracles talks about being non-dualistic, it seems dualistic because it's almost the idea of I have to escape from the illusion in order to find the reality, which is heaven, you know. Whereas I feel sorry for the universe if I have to see it as an illusion, you know. I want it to be something. I don't need it to be permanent or even real, but it is not just an illusion. Does that make sense? You know, it made a lot of effort to come into being, if you like, and therefore
I feel sorry for it.
Yeah, I want to stroke it like a little puppy. You know, yeah. You know, you're okay. You're not just an illusion. Yeah.
Well, you put it another way, you can't get rid of it.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? I mean, especially whatever it's not like we can just sort of escape. So that's, I think, That's a serious illusion to say that somehow, even if we say that all of this is really just consciousness, so that my anger itself is consciousness.
Right, sort of mind only, yeah.
It's all, you know, in a way, again, from the standpoint of experience, that's all we have is consciousness. That we have causal events occurring, but can I get rid of consciousness itself? That doesn't seem possible. I can't.
Right.
Can't just, so you, if we say even what we think of as our negative aspects like sin or anger or our confusion or whatever it might be, even those are actually nothing other than consciousness itself. The idea that somehow we're going to, you know, destroy them would mean that we'd have to destroy consciousness.
Yes.
So that's one way of thinking about, you know, so from one standpoint, we can say, well, it's an illusion, right? Like, you know, if you look at maybe, and hopefully your listeners also are sighted, you know, if you're looking at a color, even from high school physics, we know that color doesn't actually exist in the world, right? Let's just accept there's high school physics, there's photons, you know, at certain frequencies, and they interact with the retina, and then they That signal travels to the back of the brain in the visual cortex, and eventually it moves forward, and eventually we get a somehow or another, who knows really, we get a representation of a color. So we see color, like blue or white. But that color doesn't exist in the world. That color is a representation in our visual system.
Mm-hmm.
There is no blue or white in the world. There are photons moving at certain frequencies, oscillating at certain frequencies. So on that account, anyway. So you can, we never, so the, but the visual experience is of color. So in a way we could say, well, that's an illusion. Because it's, you know, if we say, well, they're really just photons. Well, yeah, that's true. It's really just photons. But on the other hand, it is a way of kind of encoding what those the photons and the frequency of their oscillation. It's a way of sort of representing that to ourselves so we can make our way in the world. So from one standpoint, it's an illusion. And from another standpoint, it isn't an illusion. And I think that in some ways is the most, is really useful for me. Which is that in one standpoint, our way of apprehending the world is illusory, especially when we get caught up in our sense of, you know, kind of being at the center of this world as the one who's controlling it. But on the other hand, we have this sort of minimal reality of our sense impressions, and things are happening to us, and their experiences are arising, and that we can't deny. I think really for me. Go ahead, yeah.
No, sorry. I mean, that reminds me of my favorite quotation, actually, from, I think it's the Lankavatara Sutra. It says, nothing is as it seems, neither is it otherwise. You know, and for me, that's a shorthand to explain all this. You know, that, yeah, it is.
Right.
It's not what it seems to be, but if you're trying to look for an alternate reality, then you're missing the point also,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the key is to shift it then. So once one sees that, which is like, well, you know, this is not what it seems to be. I think I've been thinking it's what it seems to be. I've been, you know, sort of assuming that I'm here, the one trying to control this. And if I could just get it right, I could be happy and free of suffering. You know, if I could just kind of, you know, be good enough at managing this situation, then everything would be fine. And sort of letting go of that perspective and then moving from an I to a we, right? There's a great phrase. So that's where compassion really becomes a crucial element. It's just shifting. Compassion is sort of shifting the natural urge for oneself to be happy and to be suffering from, instead of myself, instead of I, it's all of us, right? It's we. So, you know, there's a great phrase in Shantideva's, his name means peace god. He wrote a text of the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama really likes. And one of the verses says, Ye kechit dukkita loke sarvete so sukechaya, ye kechit sukkita loke sarvetenya sukechaya. And that's in Sanskrit. All of those in the world who are unhappy because they're fixated on their own happiness. And all those in the world who are happy because they seek the happiness of others.
Yes, very good.
It's just flipping that perspective that can really be very powerful.
Absolutely. And of course, Jesus talked about this too. And, you know, the Tonglen, the practice of Tonglen is similar, isn't it? Willingness to take on all the craziness and then transform it through into the light again and send it out to everyone in the world, really, without distinction. This is very good right now in our present state, where a lot of people are very upset with what's happened in, you know, the presidential election and can be lost in a lot of fear and alienation. And I think these practices of freeing oneself from being stuck in that and trying to be helpful through being part of the flow, you know, that's very good. We're at the end of the show. You know, I really wanted to talk about de-reification, but we didn't get to it.
That would have been a good one.
Yeah, it would have been a good one. But it's going to be a good one for another show. So I want to have you back here because this has been endlessly fascinating. I hope it's been meaningful to our listeners. I know we went a little deeper than sometimes we do, but I think we got the idea that this stuff is very practical. In 30 seconds, John, give us a pearls of wisdom that we can take into our week.
A pearl of wisdom that we can take into our week is just to remember to be grounded, And to notice, in a sense, that even if you're not trying, awareness persists.
Mm-hmm.
Just rest in that.
Yes, I love that. That all is well, actually. Like we say in Unity, you know, it's right here underneath our noses. You know, it's the last place we look, but it's already right here. Yeah, it's a very amazing. This is where the giggling gurus come from, because they realize this and they can't understand why other people don't understand it either. So all they can do is giggle. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to John. Next week, internationally well-known Franciscan monk, author, and non-dualist, Father Richard Rohr joins me. He's going to discuss his new book with me. It's called The Divine Dance, The Trinity and Your Transformation. So that should be quite fascinating. I've been fascinated with the Trinity for many years, this idea of Satchitananda, of light, love, and life as interconnected aspects of the one. So that should be a fascinating show. But this has been an amazing show. John, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Paul. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I hope we can do it again sometime.
Me too.
All right. Okay. Thanks for listening, folks. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org. This Christmas, recall the childlike joy of the holidays with The Wonder of Christmas, a new Advent booklet from Unity. Request or download your free booklet today at unity.org/UOR Advent. The Wonder of Christmas supports your Advent journey with inspirational messages, scripture, uplifting stories, beautiful poems, and more. Download or request your free copy today at unity.org/UOR Advent. That's unity.org/UOR Advent. But hurry, Advent begins November 27th.
You know the saying, a good deed is its own reward? Well, moving toward a plant-based diet and vegan lifestyle is one kind and compassionate act that isn't just its own reward. It will also reward you with vibrant health, boundless energy, an easy way to keep your weight where you want it, and according to yogis and Unity's co-founder Charles Fillmore, even give a boost to your spiritual life. On Main Street Vegan, the radio program named for the popular book, Victoria Moran will make your move in a vegan direction easy, fun, affordable, and delicious. With enticing topics and entertaining guests every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Central Time, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
The more we learn about life, the more we realize life never stands still. Life is in a constant state of growth and change. In our individual lives, we may resent change or even resist it. We often forget that our resistance doesn't stop life from changing. Our resistance keeps us locked into a negative mindset and blocks our acceptance and enjoyment of life's constant diversity and variety. Learn to recognize change as a stepping stone to greater growth and good. Meet life's changing conditions with courage and optimism. Changing your thoughts helps you change your actions and can result in positive changes in you and the world around you. This message has been brought to you by the Association of Unity Churches International. To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today